Hello, I'm Father Mitch Pacwa, and welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. Our guest tonight is a respected author and Catholic journalist who helped to anchor EWTN's live coverage of the recent papal interregnum and the events of the conclave, which culminated in the election of Robert Cardinal Prevost as our new pope, where he took the name Leo XIV. He's also the vice president and editorial director of EWTN News, which has given him unparalleled access to sources in Rome, through which he compiled a comprehensive new book called Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. Here to tell us more about Pope Leo XIV, please welcome Dr. Matthew Bunsen, employee of the network and a good friend of mine. Matthew, it is so good to have you back.
Great to be with you. I always love coming down to your show.
I enjoy having you. First of all, your title is a controversy. You're causing trouble already just
always,
by writing a title.
Yes, just by titles.
What do you mean the first American pope? What about the Pope Francis?
Pope Francis.
Wait, this is a controversy, isn't it?
Apparently, in the Wikipedia land, as they say, in social media.
Yeah.
Actually, he's been called the first Pan-American pope, which is an interesting way to put it. And in some ways, that's what we're trying to get at, that he is a pope who is a bridge builder. He's a transcendent figure in many ways for the Americas.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Jorge Maria Bergoglio was the first pope from the Americas. And in Pope Leo, though, we have somebody who has these deep ties, of course, to the United States, so North America, but he's also fallen in love with South America, with Latin America.
So he's, in particular, the country of Peru.
Of Peru, absolutely. So he's pulling together the Americas, America. So that's one of the reasons why we felt comfortable calling him the first American pope.
Yeah, no, he worked in Peru a good long time, and not just hanging out, but he was a bishop who then became a Peruvian citizen.
That's right, a naturalized citizen, yep. So he technically has, at one point as Cardinal Prevost, he had three passports.
Oh, yes.
He had the American one as a native U.S. citizen, but then also a naturalized Peruvian citizen, and then as a member of the Roman Curia and a cardinal, he traveled with, or had the right to travel with, a Vatican passport.
Sort of pick a passport, any passport, they're all due.
Well, you can keep it, I've got several. But in a way, it's a perfect way of trying to understand him a little, because he does pull all of these different threads together of different worlds in himself, and now he's bringing all of those experiences to the papacy.
See, that's one of the things about him. Some people were, mumbling and grumbling like Israelites in the desert when he didn't use English in his opening address. But he strikes me as someone who is much more than a U.S. citizen.
That's right.
Which he is.
Absolutely.
And of which we're proud. But he really is a person of the whole world. And not because he has this, starry-eyed vision of the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God and all the
universal
fog bomb
stuff.
No, he lived in the world and loved the people where he was.
Right.
You know, this is a very important aspect that really helps him to be a pope of the universal church.
That's absolutely true. And I think it's one of the reasons why he was elected. Mm-hmm. I think it's also one of the reasons why, contrary to conventional wisdom, which is always a dangerous thing, conventional wisdom said that he was certainly eminently qualified as a papabile, as somebody who could be elected pope. But people I would talk to, for example, experts in Rome, would always say, yes, he's certainly qualified. He checks all the boxes that we'd be looking for somebody to be pope, and yet he's unelectable. And why? Because he was an American. He's a U.S. citizen. And yet, after the conclave, the American cardinals who were there held a press conference at the North American College. This is right after he was elected pope. And they were asked, were you shocked? And of course, everyone was a little surprised that a U.S. citizen, an American, had been elected. And yet, one of the things that I think it was Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, the Archbishop Emeritus of Galveston, Houston, said that he really was more of a transcendent, almost a universal figure because of his experiences.
Exactly.
He's an American citizen. Yes, he grew up in Chicago. Yes, he's still a White Sox fan. And yet, he had...
With great disappointment for us Cub fans, but that's okay.
I know, exactly. That's why I raised it. I wanted to get that out of the way as soon as possible for you. Just ease the pain. But he'd been gone for decades, and he had lived in Peru, worked in Peru, and then he'd worked in Rome, he'd traveled the world. So he was, one way to put it is he was the least American that you could possibly find among certainly the American cardinals.
But never an anti-American
at all. Exactly, that's the thing.
See, that's...
Right. He's not un-American.
Right.
He's been gone for a long time.
He's bigger. Right. He includes that. It's the ability to incorporate that background.
That's right.
And expand way beyond it. It's a starting point of life, you know, where you're born and how you're raised. But
We can't ignore the fact that in Robert Francis Prevost, he is still very much somebody who grew up in the faith in Chicago, who was shaped by that whole environment.
Yeah.
And that was one of the points you wanted to make in the book.
You did. And as I was reading it, I certainly recognized the Chicago Catholicism in which I grew up.
Yeah.
Insofar as I ever grew up. But
Don't.
Yeah, really not. No danger. One of the things about his American background that is not well known, talk about his ethnic background of his grandparents and stuff. What did you find?
He's sort of classically American in the sense that we are that phrase melting pot. We are a diverse culture, but I mean, obviously, we're in a different era when we use words like diversity.
Yes.
But he does truly represent that great melting pot of the sort of multicultural, but it's that coming together of so many different cultures. So you see on his dad's side, his father, Louis, where you have this beautiful background of Italian and French. On his mom's side, you have Creole. You've got the Haitian. You have her growing up in New Orleans, Ward 7 of New Orleans, and then making her way to Chicago. So he is this great coming together, as we have seen in American history.
What's so special about Ward 7 in New Orleans?
Well, it's because it was a haven for beautiful Creole culture and in the life of New Orleans itself. Mm-hmm. So it's this great cultural moment of the spot in Louisiana.
And a lot of folks may not know, when they go to New Orleans, they think of Cajun food, which is wonderful.
Yes.
But so is Creole food. And there's some great Creole restaurants and a culture that is so classy and wonderful to enjoy. Right. But it's a combination of African culture and Spanish and French and Native American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Creole are a mixture of these, and that's his background. So he's part African American, part Native American.
Part French, part Spanish, part Italian. Right, classic American.
Part Caribbean. I mean, his grandfather was from the island of Hispaniola, which includes...
Right.
And you said in there that his passport included, or his papers included, that he's from Haiti, as well as from Santo Domingo. And the line was probably fairly fluid.
Yes, it is. And he himself continues to acknowledge that. When in various speeches he's given since his election, he mentions the fact that I am part of a family that migrated.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting use of that term because it's a very specific one. It's people who have migrated, who have moved to different places and have found a home somewhere.
Yeah.
And certainly his family came together in that beautiful way that Americans historically have.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that really strikes me, though, about his growing up in the Chicago area is how seemingly ordinary it appears.
Yeah.
There's nothing remotely extraordinary at first glance at a family. It was a middle-class family, in suburban Chicago, just outside of Chicago.
Yeah, when we say suburban,
right,
you have to qualify that for Dalton and
exactly.
that area, Calumet City. That's where my family's from.
Right.
I have one grandfather from Cal City, but most of my relatives on my mom's side came from Hegewisch, which is the farthest south Chicago
right.
goes, 132nd, 133rd Street is the line. And he comes from, what, 131st?
Mm-hmm.
But just a little bit west, so it's slightly out of the city, but it's a working class area.
Right.
And Holland had been truck farms, mm-hmm. Nearby where he was. So
right.
it's
and went to school for a time.
Yeah, and so all right. of this area is very working class, very Chicago, very Catholic.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. It was a classic, use that word again, American yeah. community, but a classic American Catholic community in mm-hmm. the 1950s and into the 60s. He was born in 1955.
Yeah.
And right in that period just before the council. And the significance of that whole period of rapid growth in American Catholicism, sort of peaking in the 60s, mm-hmm. that he would have known. But the thing that I keep coming back to when we study his life is that the family just lived the faith, that the parish was so important to them. They would walk to Mass. They would have priests over for dinner. It was like a traditional Catholic environment.
And his father was a catechist.
Right.
And his mother was in the choir mm-hmm. and was a great singer.
And the Altered Rosary Society. All the things that we associate with sort of American Catholicism for that era,
yeah.
they lived.
And even to be a catechist back in those days was not just taking a job or a role within the parish,
right.
or as they say today, a ministry. You were part of the confraternity for Catholic doctrine. Mm-hmm. That this is there's a wonderful book I recommend people get and look at. It's called Bowling Alone. That one of the big contrasts between today's culture mm-hmm. and 1950s culture and early 60s as well, is that people belonged to smaller groups mm-hmm. within society. Not only the church, but Altar and Rosary Society.
Right.
The Holy Name Society was mm-hmm. full of men who were committed to keeping the name of Jesus holy. The yeah. confraternity, various sodalities. There were lots and lots of small groups. And sociologically, just want to be secular,
yeah.
all of these small groups build up all of society because you have connections with each mm-hmm. other.
Right.
And today, people don't even join a bowling league because they don't want to be so limited by a commitment to go bowling every Wednesday night.
Right. Let alone pray for their souls.
Yeah. Yeah
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Catholic culture, seemingly, I said it before, seemingly very, very ordinary. Nothing truly remarkable about it. And
yeah.
yet it produced three sons who loved the faith, one in particular, Robert, who displayed an obvious love of the priesthood as a kid. I mean, he pretended to say Mass. He'd use Necco wafers and all of that, an ironing board for the altar, and his brothers would be the congregation, probably an unruly congregation. But he lived in this beautiful Catholic life.
Yes.
And it stuck in a way that I think it's a lesson for families today. And the key to it, the love of his parents for them, the love of his mom, who taught them how to pray, and then the love and support of his dad.
In having both parents
right.
involved in church, and they both went to church.
Right.
Especially it's again, sociologically, it's part of life. Mm-hmm. That when the dad goes to church and leads the family in participation in the spiritual life of the family, the family tends to stay Catholic.
It does.
If dad isn't around for that, I find God on the golf course. Not by the language you use
right.
over there.
Or gym is my church.
Yes. Yeah. No.
We can see how significant that background is in just the some of the things he's already said as Pope. Now, obviously, he is reiterating, and I think he's doing a beautiful job doing it, a church teaching on the importance of family, on marriage, that it is a union of a man and a woman. He has, on several occasions, gone, when he didn't even have to, he has stressed that. But you can see why it matters to him.
Yes.
A, because it's church teaching, it works every time it's tried. But he's also recognizing from his own lived experience the importance of raising children in that environment, in the faith. And for him, I think you could see there was a moment when he was still discerning the call to religious life, the call to the priesthood. And he was talking with his dad. And his dad gave him this encouragement. He didn't push him, but he said, you know, pray on this. Decide what you want to do. Discern what you want to do. Whatever you do will support you. And you know, at a time when 80%, if not more, of young Catholic men are discerning or may feel a call to the priesthood or the religious life, they're never asked.
Yeah.
And so do we have a crisis in vocations? Maybe not, simply because they're getting the call, but they're not being encouraged in it. And his parents were there every step of the way for him. And I think that's absolutely fundamental in understanding the arc, the trajectory for Robert Prevost toward the priesthood, but then also for the religious life.
Yeah. Now, he, like we, have lived through a time where that same wonderful, it really was, it was a fun culture.
Right.
You know, and of course, I'm Polish-American, but I loved it when the Italian parishes had their festivals.
Yep.
They had great food.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our festivals, and there were great food, at, no matter what ethnic group it was, the Mexican parishes or the Polish parishes.
Right.
You loved it. That, mm-hmm. And that was Catholicism.
Right.
Yeah, you had ethnic parishes, but they invited everybody of the church in to celebrate who they are, while at the same time we were all Catholic. But that wonderful culture, and also in his case, we'll talk more about this, but it was a culture that really focused on educating the young.
Mm-hmm.
There were, in his parish, like the rest of them, wonderful nuns who gave their lives so that we could get a decent education. And, you know, the Catholic school system in Chicago was the third largest school system in the country,
mm-hmm.
after New York and the Chicago public school system.
That's right.
It was, in fact, the public school in our parish had one floor empty. And if they had let us, we would have rented it out and we would have filled it with Catholic kids. But be that as it may, you know, that culture collapsed and we've lived through that. His parish is now
it's not gone, used. Right, exactly.
It's an empty
one
church.
One of the schools that he was planning to go to for his formation for the Augustinians, that closed. It's one of the reasons he ended up at Villanova after he really began this whole process of formation with the Augustinians.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this sort of peak period, and we don't blame the council or anything like that.
But no.
Post-conciliar period was one of a lot of challenges for American Catholicism. The great tides that washed over the church and the world of these revolutions, the sexual, cultural, political,
The
drug revolution. All of those things impacting American Catholicism. So we had this period of retraction and a certain instability.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we don't blame the council in any way for that.
I don't. We were given the council documents as our senior year high school textbook. And there was no problem with it.
No.
But the problem came when faculty at the next, because I was in seminary too, in the 60s. I started seminary during the council.
Mm-hmm.
In 63 I started. And it was more of a problem of introducing existential psychology,
right,
into the formation of the men. Instead of teaching prayer, they use psychological counseling. And that's not prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe helpful for people that need it and such, but it replaced prayer among many of the faculty at the college level seminary that was catastrophic.
Right.
So these are some of the background. We can do that in another show.
Right, but this is sort of what he lived through.
Yes.
So he lived through this beautiful period of family life, of a strong Catholic family, but then he also saw the changes that were happening in culture and elsewhere. I think it's also one of the reasons why, when he talks about things like formation for use of social media, he has seen the impact that culture can have on people. I think it's also one of the reasons why he's very focused on things like artificial intelligence. It's I think we can talk more about this, why he took the name Leo XIV, in exactly the same way that Leo XIII was confronting these great industrial and technological revolutions of his time. Leo XIV is very concerned about the technological, intellectual, and AI revolutions that we're facing today, and it always keeps coming back to the impact that the Industrial Revolution had on the human person, the impact that the AI revolutions are having on the person.
I think, though, to sort of pull together that having lived through this period of collapsing chaos, again, my high school seminary class had 530 guys. 530 guys, not in my school,
right?
In my class,
right?
And 36 of us got ordained.
Similar numbers from his junior high school.
Exactly.
Right.
And which was, you know, a seminary as well. So, and I think that's also key to his motto, as well as to his attitude. We have to keep the person of Jesus Christ at the center.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about his motto and what that means.
Well, when he was named a bishop for apostolic administrator, he was consecrated a bishop in 2014. He chose, as all bishops do, a motto that sort of represents where you're coming from, sort of your worldview and things that are important to you. So he chose, in illo uno unum, in the one, we are one. Now, it accomplishes two interesting things. The first is it tells us that in Christ we are one. So he takes unity in Christ to be the heart of everything he wants to accomplish. And we can talk about how he's already doing that as Pope. This is also a recognition of the work of Augustine, his commentary on Psalm 127, which is from which this is taken. So in Christ we are one. And this recognition that division, fragmentation, the problems that we have in culture, globally, and in the church, that we have to find a source of unity. What were the first words that he said as Pope? Peace be with you. So the proclamation of the words of Jesus Christ. But then in his very first words as Pope, he says, peace of the risen Christ. So he's being very specific about what kind of peace he's talking about.
It's not a kumbaya moment, let's just get along.
Right, it's not a false peace, it's not a peace of treaties, it's not this idea of can we all just get along, it's not this false amity. No, it is rooted in the peace that only Christ can give you. And it's the peace that then leads you to unity because we have Christ.
This is a very important point. Because, again, for those of us who lived through the period of the 60s, 70s, and beyond, one of the issues was that I think in the shaking of the church is there was a loss of emphasis on the centrality of Jesus Christ. And I think it was a fear. Well, what if Jesus doesn't come through? Then we still have existential psychology. We have, you know, Eric Fromm and Carl Rogers. Right. And we've got a church where we can all sit around and look at each other and form community. And just in case Jesus doesn't do it, we've got these others. And the more that fear de-emphasized the centrality of Christ and grace and emphasized our efforts and what we do, the fewer people came to church. If Jesus isn't the reason, if you had liturgists saying about churches, well, the Blessed Sacrament is kind of a distraction. You mean Jesus himself is a distraction at Mass? Who's the main attraction? You?
Right.
Come on, cut it out. And we have to focus on Jesus, and that's this Pope's
emphasis. And as an Augustinian, some of the great hallmarks of the Augustinian rule, of the Augustinian life that, Augustine of Hippo left, and that beautiful tradition that is extended throughout the history of the Augustinians, is this pursuit of the truth. It is this, the pursuit of God. It is the pursuit of Christ, of course. But then the love of God impels you toward the love of neighbor, but that also means you have to be united. There has to be unity there. And for them, then, also the Eucharist as the source of unity in the life of the church. So this impulse toward unity is very much present in this great Augustinian tradition.
Let's talk. What drew him to the Augustinian order? How did he get in connection with them, and how has his Augustinian background affected the way he lives and thinks?
Yeah, well, we know that from his youth, he was having encounters with Augustinians because of their presence in that region. And he was drawn to Augustine somewhere along the line. He just found him of great interest, and then had this opportunity to study. He was called to the priesthood, but he was also called to the religious life. And he found in the Augustinians exactly what he was looking for. And providentially, there was this Augustinian junior seminary right nearby where he went in Michigan. And so that journey continued his fascination with the Augustinian tradition and Augustine himself, but it also introduced him, I think, to the magnificent world of patristics. He is so filled, his homilies, his speeches, his references to the great fathers of the church, not just Augustine, who he quotes him in almost every speech, which makes sense.
Of course.
But he's pulling in Leo the Great, he's pulling in Ignatius of Antioch. He's pulling in obscure doctors of the church like Ephrem the Syrian.
What do you mean obscure? We lose him every day.
And Gregory of
Narek.
In your church, yes, exactly. But that's also a statement, too, of the breadth of his consideration, his great love of the Eastern Catholic churches, yeah, for example. So he was called into this life of the Augustinians, and it was sort of mutual. I think the Augustinians realized very quickly that they had in this Robert Prevost a pretty remarkable young man. And so he goes to Villanova, an Augustinian institution, because the other option had closed. And he studies, of all things, mathematics, which is an interesting choice. Under the National Catholic Register, Matt McDonald, one of our great reporters, has done a whole piece on Leo the mathematician. And because this is now a great moment for Catholic math majors, because as far as we can tell, he's probably the first pope who also was a math major.
No, he's not.
So who's the other one?
Urban VIII.
Urban VIII, that's true. Yeah, and
Urban
his fascination with Galileo.
Where do you pull this stuff out from? But yeah, he was the one that silenced Galileo.
Exactly.
And he was a mathematician and a scientist himself.
Right. In terms of college, is what we're thinking, the modern papacy.
Oh, yeah, well, modern, that's...
Yeah.
But when do you start modern? I mean, I start modern at 200 A.D.
Fair enough. Very, very fair. So this love of mathematics, but it also demonstrates a desire and an innate calling for precision in what he does.
It's why
he's very precise in his liturgies, for example.
That's what I disliked about math class. You had to have the right answer and show how you got there.
Likewise, yeah. I was not called to be a math major.
Mine neither.
Which is also one of the reasons why he is so competent as a canon lawyer.
Bingo.
So they send him to Rome to earn a doctorate, first a licentiate, and then he finished his doctorate at the Angelicum, the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome.
And so but if I can just add on to this a little sidebar, I have noticed a number of young men. Just last week, I was giving a retreat to a seminarian who is trained in engineering. Mm-hmm. I know a number of engineers, mathematicians, scientists who are entering seminary. And I love it because it does give them this mental ability to think very logically and clearly about important things.
Right, yeah. And What's also interesting is, and one of the hallmarks of the Augustinians is also service. It is a life of service because, again, you're impelled toward love of neighbor, which means take this out into the world to serve. And so his doctoral dissertation at the Angelicum was on the role and responsibility of a prior, Augustinian priors in the
local. Who's the superior of the community.
Right, in that local community, in the community itself. Mm-hmm. So it was taken up, I've had a chance to read much of it, and it's taken up with obviously the canonical aspects of what their rights and everything else, but he's also quite interested in not just responsibilities, but how they serve. Mm-hmm. How they care for those who are under their authority. Mm-hmm. And you could see some of that even in his installation mass, and the mass for the mm-hmm. start of the Petrine ministry of the Bishop of Rome, as it's called, on May 18th, when he was given the pallium and everything else. And he used that phrase that as Pope, you are not called to be an autocrat, but he also made the point it's one of service. Obviously, to serve servorum Dei.
Yeah, going back to Pope Gregory I, the Great.
Exactly. So he's very interested in the recognition of humility, of service for those whom you govern. Mm-hmm. And it's a pastoral outlook, I think, that is very Augustinian. Certainly, that was something that Augustine was taken up with. But he's also, and we have seen this since his election, he has gone back, he's had lunch with his Augustinians where he lived, which is pretty much across the street from the Vatican, across the street from the Palazzo Sant'Uffizio, where mm-hmm. he lived in his service as prefect for the Dicastery of Bishops as a cardinal. He would dine at this Augustinian, the headquarters there, at the Augustinianum, which was a great patristic school. And you could tell from the videos and things that he has said that the friendship for him is so very important, of hospitality. All hallmarks of the Augustinian tradition, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see how that translates into his vision for the universal church of hospitality, of friendship, but it's still rooted in the love of Christ and the unity that only Christ can bring.
Yeah. We have to take a little break. We're going to come back in just a moment and continue on this discussion, giving this portrait of Pope Leo XIV. So please stay with us. Welcome back. We are talking to Dr. Matthew Bunsen about a book he wrote, obviously very quickly. It's called Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. You can get this book now. It's item number 84372. 84372. And it is available at EWTNRC.com. I've really enjoyed it, partly because I've lived through the same period of time.
Right.
And I recognize so many of the things that have happened. Again, his growing up in Chicago like I did, and
right.
the kind of Catholic life that we lived.
And you've been in Peru.
And that's what I wanted to talk about next.
Right.
I worked in Peru back in the 1975, before he had even started with the Augustinians, I guess.
Just starting.
He was just getting there. So let's talk about that. He went after studies mm-hmm. in Rome, getting a doctorate in canon law.
Well, sort of almost at the same time. What's really interesting, and I mentioned that the Augustinians were very impressed, obviously, with him. Mm-hmm. So at Villanova, he not only studied mathematics, he also was studying Hebrew and Latin, which is unusual for somebody who's a math major, no offense to math majors. So he was clearly very much having discerned the priesthood. And then he goes through formation, preparation. He has his MDiv from the Catholic Theological Union in the Chicago area.
Yes.
Is ordained in 1982. And then within just a few years, he is sent to Peru to begin this missionary work. And we were talking about how he's a very universal type of a figure. Mm-hmm. One of the hallmarks of his life has been his remarkable capacity to adapt to almost any surroundings, any circumstances in which he finds himself, mm-hmm. which of course is a hallmark of a great missionary. Francis Xavier had this ability to arrive in almost any location in Asia and grasp immediately the subtleties and nuances of culture, of the language, of the customs, the traditions.
And for somebody like Francis Xavier, for the Pope and for other missionaries, it's because they truly love the people they're going to. They're focused on bringing the love of Christ to them as they are, not as they should be or would be. They're not going to make Chicago-style hot dogs, you know, down in Peru.
Right. Yeah, it's helping them have an encounter with Christ.
Yeah.
And so he's sent to Peru and immediately begins impressing those in the missionary field there. With his capacity to begin mastering Spanish fluently, but also Quechua and the indigenous languages of the region.
Yeah, a lot of folks don't realize there are still a number of Peruvians who barely speak some Spanish mm-hmm. as a sort of second language. They speak Quechua, the language of the ancient Incas.
That's right.
And, of course, it's modern Quechua, so mm-hmm. it's still developing.
Right.
But, yeah, it's a totally different language.
Very different thing. Yeah. And so he understood innately the role of the missionary, which is to be with the people, to help them encounter Christ, but mm-hmm. to be at their service. And then he's finishing his canon law degree in 1987. He goes back briefly to the U.S. He goes back to Peru, serves there for many, many years in what is a really rugged environment, obviously. And you've been there.
Yes.
In that part of the world. And he's also, so it's two worlds, I think, were sort of intersecting for him in Peru. There was the missionary field, where he's riding donkeys and horses and driving over hither and yon, which he loves to do. One of his favorite things to do as a kid, when he was younger, was to drive. If he could drive rather than fly, he loved to drive.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to hit the open road.
Yeah.
So that tells us something about him.
Yeah.
He loves the adventure of it.
And so, let me assure you, driving in Peru is not driving the open road.
Right.
It is going around these hairpin turns with cliffs that descend sometimes thousands of feet, mm-hmm. and there's no guardrail. Right. With crazy drivers coming at you from the other direction, truly careening. I mean, it was dangerous to drive in the mountains.
That was his daily life.
Yeah.
And
then someplace there are no roads. You had to take horses and mules.
Right. And so he's got that whole world, and he's founding parishes. He's doing baptisms. And he was a genuinely beloved figure in all of the missionaries that he was serving. But he was also now very seriously interacting with the Peruvian diocese, the institutional church in Peru, because he was a talented canonist. So he was a rector of a seminary. He was great at recruiting for the Augustinians. He was relied on for canonical advice in various tribunals. So there was this missionary side, but then there was also this institutional side. And I think he was absorbing both of those worlds, mm-hmm. And both of them, I think, proved really important, and were one of the reasons why he was eventually appointed and elected the head of all of the Augustinians in the world. And he mm-hmm. served in that role for basically from about 2010 to 2012, 2013. All of this, the task of traveling the world on behalf of the Augustinian orders, which brought him back to Rome. And it was said of him, and this is, I think, a key insight into how he's going to function as Pope, that over those two terms of the 12 years as head of the Augustinians, that at the end of it, there was not a single person in the order who had felt he had done them an injustice. That the way he went about making decisions, it wasn't just consensus building, it was a genuine process of listening, of bringing in an expert, getting everybody's opinion, being prudential, being judicious in how he made a decision, mm-hmm. but making sure that it was a just one at the end of the day. But when he also made that decision, it stuck. It wasn't something that he would back he wouldn't backpedal on decisions, but he also wouldn't be arbitrary in his decisions. Mm-hmm. That says a lot about his style of leadership, and I think you could see some of that going back to this doctoral dissertation mm-hmm. about what it means to serve, to wield that authority in the life of the church.
Yeah. See, this is a very important role that would prepare him for papacy. The papacy is a role of servant leadership, and both aspects mm-hmm. are there. And again, that Augustinian sense that you're called to communion with Christ and with the members mm-hmm. of your community, I think permeate him, and I think will continue, looks like it will continue on to right. permeate the way that he looks at leadership in the church. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be a very important thing for all of us to
There's a funny thing, too, because he at one point had a disagreement with Pope Francis, but this is before Pope Francis was elected. And it had to do with a personnel decision down in Argentina when mm-hmm. he was still Jorge Maria Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. And apparently he joked at one point, well, when Francis was elected, he said, well, I will certainly not becoming a bishop now. I will not become a bishop because I had this disagreement. Now, the two of them reached some sort of an agreement about it, and clearly there were no hard feelings on the part of Pope Francis toward him.
Yeah.
Why? Because he appointed Father Prevost, fresh from having served as head of the Augustinians, to this position of apostolic administrator in Chiclayo. So he sends him back to Peru, but this time to serve as a bishop, and in mm-hmm. short order named him Bishop of Chiclayo. Which it's a logical track, but it's a statement of the trust that Pope Francis had in him mm-hmm. in this role. And there he served with great distinction among the Peruvian bishops. He's an American. He's a U.S. citizen, U.S. born, and yet he became naturalized there and became a really important part of a respected figure in the Episcopal Conference of Peru. So that he served as vice president there, held a variety of positions. And that was crucial, I think, as Francis was watching him. You have that very distinct impression. He had a meeting with him in 2021. It was just the two of them. And that's when some of the rumors began that Francis might be having something in mind for Bishop Prevost that mm-hmm. was bigger than Peru. And sure enough, in 2023, Francis plucks him out of seeming obscurity. Just the Bishop of Chiclayo in Peru is brought to Rome to take over as prefect for the Dicastery of Bishops. Now, for those who may not be familiar with that, that is the Vatican office that oversees the whole process for the appointment of bishops.
All over the world.
Mm-hmm. The only ones that that office doesn't oversee are the ones who fall technically under the prefecture, the Dicastery for Evangelization, because those are the younger dioceses and mission mm-hmm. territories. Mm-hmm. It's a huge promotion. I mean, it was a shock to a lot of people that that was the role that he got. Mm-hmm. And then within just months, he's made a cardinal.
Mm-hmm. And see, I think even from the disagreement, you know, a lot of times when you disagree with somebody, you go, you know, at least some boys sometimes duke it out and become friends afterward
right. yes.
because there's a mutual respect in the way that the dispute was handled. Not that they came to blows, but
right.
but they could disagree, mm-hmm. strongly hold an opinion, but respect the way that, that's their perspective. And you see that.
Right.
And you can also see the talent and the gifts of the other person and respect it.
And the skills that he had and displayed as the head of the Augustinians, he brought with him into this new role as prefect. Mm-hmm. And those who have served with him have commented publicly that in that 2-year span when he was serving in this role, they never saw him lose his temper. He never got angry about things. Now, he wasn't emotionally detached from things. It's very clear that he has a good sense of humor. He has he can laugh about things. But he's also very sober. He's very serious. And, mm-hmm. and again, he's very thoughtful. But never seeing him lose his temper. And I think how he solved problems in that role, I think, was very notable for a lot of cardinals.
See, I think that's also a key part of any Christian maturity. When you say that you lose your temper, it means your temper has control and you don't.
Right.
You know, and, you know, to have that ability to, you know, be calm and at peace is not a matter of having disinterest or not caring. It's rather much more focused on this is what we do, and we think through this and weigh the things rather than use emotion to manipulate other people
right.
or ourselves.
One of the cardinal electors from Latin America, Cardinal Chomoli, made the observation about him. He said he has one mouth but two ears, and he listens. He would listen to people who were sitting in front of them. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting too, because he's somebody who focuses very intently in meetings on the person mm-hmm. he's meeting with. Mm-hmm. And that was another one of the hallmarks of his time as prefect for the Dicastery of Bishops. What is also notable is that I think his tenure as a cardinal was very brief. I mean, he was made a cardinal in 2023, 2024. That position, I think, was very clearly a sign of Francis's favor, that he thought very highly of him. Mm-hmm. There was another little side thing about that so he makes him a cardinal, and you always get a titular church in Rome. That's your connection to
the Roman Church.
The Roman Church.
Yeah.
He then promoted him. Within the College of Cardinals, you have different ranks of cardinals. And you have cardinal deacons and cardinal priests and cardinal bishops. He promoted him into the ranks of the cardinal bishops, mm-hmm. which is the most senior of all of the cardinal ranks. Mm-hmm. And he then moved him to what is called the Suburbicarian See. So those are the dioceses that surround Rome. So as the most senior cardinals, you would be assigned to one of those. You're not actually bishop there, but
why it's titular. You have that in your title.
Exactly.
But it's, you let the bishop do his job.
Right, yes. But it's another sign of influence and position. Mm-hmm. And he was given the title of the Suburbicarian See of Albano. Mm-hmm. So that's why, if you go back and you watch like the procession of the cardinals into the Sistine Chapel, if you look at the orders of processions, he was always right at the front. Mm-hmm. Or the very back, depending upon how you're organizing seniority.
Yes.
The point is that he was one of the most senior cardinals in the College of Cardinals. So mm-hmm. this was a statement, again, of respect on the part of Pope Francis. And it's a statement, too, of how easily he moved into those new positions in Rome. Mm-hmm. There was just the comfort level that he seems to have in settling into roles. And we're already starting to see that. In his functioning as Pope.
And you don't, I don't pick up any sense, I don't know if you heard any rumors of this. There's some people who within the church really try to nuzzle their way up the hierarchy. Right. They'll do, oh yeah, I can do that.
Right.
I don't think he was that kind of person.
No, he said that he was very, very reluctant to accept the position in Rome. He loved Ciclayo.
Yeah.
You mentioned that he began on the loggia. He spoke Spanish. He didn't speak English. There's a reason for that, I think. But mm-hmm. he came out. He spoke three languages that day on May 8th.
Right.
Latin, Italian. He's a bishop of Rome, so of course he's going to speak. Latin's the official language of the church. He spoke Italian. He's a bishop of Rome. But he also spoke Spanish, which some people found very surprising. But what did he use the Spanish for? He was talking. It was a shout-out to his old diocese of Ciclayo.
Right.
It came from the heart because he missed Ciclayo. He genuinely loves Peru.
And I'm going to add to that, you know, having been there, it's easy to love the Peruvian people. And he was there at a difficult time. Mm-hmm. There was a period where a vicious
That's right.
communist movement called the Shining Path, mostly influenced by the Chinese communists. Mm-hmm. They were vicious.
Yeah.
And
planning to spark Maoist Marxist revolutions all over Latin America.
I mean, these folks were going around Peru killing other communists mm-hmm. because they weren't radical enough. And they
unsurprising
weren't...
when it comes to communists, but yes.
Yes. Well, that's why communism, you know, has so many purges. You know, they're mean. Mm-hmm. There's just no way around it. They're to each other. And then... to elders if they can be.
Yeah.
So, but the Shining Path was vicious.
It was.
I have Jesuit friends who were targeted by Shining Path, mm-hmm. You know, because they were working with the Quechua. And they targeted the church mm-hmm. as well as the government.
Right.
So it was a very vicious, dangerous time. I mean, the number of murders and killings that went on at the hands of Shining Path. And then the government, as you described, you know, came out under President Fujimori mm-hmm. With its own viciousness.
Right.
They reacted with a viciousness back, which was
awful. And Robert Prevost.
That was also evil.
Exactly. And Robert Prevost called them both out.
Yes. Exactly.
And that, I think, is very important. He didn't side with either side because he recognized that, 70,000 people were killed in that period.
Yes.
And he called out the Shining Path. He called out the Fujimori allies and those who were doing what they were doing. He stood in front of armed gunmen from the Shining Path who were trying to kidnap seminarians. But then he also spoke out against the Fujimori government and also the pardon that was given to Fujimori at one point. So he walked this path. Why? Because he was principally concerned with the preservation of human dignity, of the threat that was coming to so many people in Peru, and was speaking out on behalf of peace, on behalf of stability.
Yeah, another way to put it, he was speaking out on behalf of love of this people that love him and he loved, and against those who were filled with violence and hatred. This is crucial.
And it's important to know that, so we have the first U.S.-born pope, and Americans have, especially American Catholics, have every right to an immense amount of pride. I think this is an important moment for American Catholicism, U.S. Catholicism.
Yes.
But we can't underestimate how proud Peru is of this adopted son, who's now Pope Leo XIV. And I think that mention of his diocese, that mention of Peru on the day he was elected was a reminder of them, of how much he really did love them.
Yes.
And I think it was also a very smart, strategic decision on his part that he's not speaking English, because we go back to, in many ways, how we started this conversation tonight, and that is that an American could never be elected. And one of the primary reasons, America is this vast superpower. It influences everything. Mm-hmm. And so the assumption was that a U.S. person could never, a U.S. cardinal could never be elected because it would be perceived as this American takeover of the papacy next.
Right.
False as that would be, regardless of who is going to be elected.
Not Cardinal Burke or Supich or Egan or any of them would. They're not going to be.
Exactly. he didn't speak English that day. He spoke Spanish. It was something from the heart. But the next morning, the next day, when he says Mass in the Sistine Chapel with the cardinals who had just elected him the day before, he starts by talking in English.
Yes.
So it was not a fix of something that he didn't do the day before. It's rather, this is also part of me. Yeah. I'm also American. And he's been very tactical and very shrewd, not in a calculating way, but he's been very smart in how he has used English since his election.
Yeah, and dealt with his own American identity. We could keep on going, but we can't.
Alas.
We're out of time. I want to, again, encourage you. If you want to find out something about Pope Leo, just get your initial portrait. That's what this book is. Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope by Dr. Matthew Bunsen, our guest today. It's item number 84372. 84372. And you can get it at our religious catalog, EWTNRC.com. Thank you again for being with us
and
for writing this. And may the Lord bless you all and keep you and cause his face to shine upon you and lead you in all of your ways by his peace. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
And I want to remind you, you know, Mother Angelica was inspired to start this network, which is expanding all over the place. But she was inspired also to have it brought to you by you rather than by advertisers. So please keep us in between your gas bill, electric bill, and cable bill. And then we can do this program, the great news division that Dr. Bunsen heads, and all the other programs that we have. Thank you for your support, and God bless you all.